At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hi, this is Tony Bruschi. You're about to listen to our brand new podcast, Dark Side of Wikipedia. Being a brand new show, we need to let other folks know that this thing exists so we can keep doing it. I'd greatly appreciate your help in that effort by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, and I'm going to make it worth your while as well. We're going to give away a $200 Amazon gift certificate to one person who left us a review. All you have to do is leave that review on Apple Podcasts, take a screenshot of it, and then send it to me. Send it to review@darksideofwiki.com. So, again, to review, leave the review at Apple Podcasts, take the screenshot, and then send it to me. Review@darksideofwiki.com. That's the email address. Review@darksideofwiki.com. Very soon, I'll select one person to get that $200 Amazon gift card as a thank you for leaving that review and letting other folks know we exist. Also, be sure to share us on social media, let your friends and family know, and be sure to press that subscribe button as well as we get another great podcast off the ground. I hope you enjoy The Dark Side of Wikipedia. What do you do when everyone thought the better version of you turns out to be anything but? When a man is able to outsmart doctors and, more importantly, outsmart his future victims, leaving a trail of death, destruction, and lives destroyed in his horrible wake. Today, we hear the very dark and true story of Ed Kemper.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Edmund Emil Kemper III is an American serial killer and necrophile who murdered 10 people, including his paternal grandparents and mother. He's noted for his large size at 6 feet 9 inches and for his high intellect, possessing an IQ of 145. Kemper was nicknamed the co-ed killer, as most of his victims were female students at co-educational institutions. Born in California, Kemper had a disturbed upbringing. His parents divorced and he moved to Montana with his abusive mother as a child before returning to California, where he murdered his paternal grandparents when he was 15. He was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic by court psychiatrists and sentenced to the state hospital for the criminally insane juveniles. Released at the age of 21 after convincing psychiatrists he was rehabilitated, Kemper was regarded as a non-threatening individual by his future victims. He targeted young female hitchhikers during his killing spree, luring them into his vehicle and driving them to secluded areas where he would murder them before taking their corpses back to his home to be decapitated, dismembered, and violated. Kemper then murdered his mother and one of her friends before turning himself into authorities. Found sane and guilty at his trial in 1973, Kemper requested the death penalty for his crimes. Capital punishment was suspended in California at the time, and he insisted and instead received 8 concurrent life sentences. Since then, he has been incarcerated in the California Medical Facility. Kemper has waived his right to a parole hearing several times, and he said he is happy in prison. So I think what led a lot of us to learn the story of Ed Kemper and his magical journey was
yeah.
was the show Mindhunter.
Yeah, season one specifically.
Yeah, he was a very prolific character on that show. And you really started to go, oh my God, this is a real person. And then you start, you know, that's how I did it. I did what this show does. I think it might have even been sort of an inspiration for the idea of this show.
Yeah.
Because I'm someone who will sit there and Wikipedia things as I'm watching TV. Like, is this true? What, mm-hmm. How accurate is this? And then I'll sit there and then mindlessly read it forever. And then I thought, hey, podcast.
Yeah.
There's the idea. But that's where I first learned of Ed Kemper. I'm Tony Bruschi, Jenny Bruschi, joining us on today's episode as well. You?
Yeah, that was where I had heard of him for the first time.
You didn't have like Ed Kemper posters in your room when you were a teenager?
No.
Like next to George Michael or anything?
No.
Ed Kemper?
Neither, but I mean, I had heard the term the co-ed killer, but I didn't know what he did or who he was or any of that.
Sure.
That was the only familiar part.
Yeah, I'd heard the term too, but I did not know his name.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know the full story other than I kind of guessed somewhat of what he did. But it turns out to be much darker than just the title.
Right.
It doesn't have the same ring to it when it's like the co-ed dismember, decapitating, you know, necrophiliac man.
Right.
Co-ed killer, it's more of a ring to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a twisted story. And we'll dive more into it here on the dark side of Wikipedia today as we continue to learn about Ed Kemper. Edmund Emeril Kemper III was born in Burbank, California on December 18, 1948. He was the middle child and only son born to Charnel Elizabeth Kemper and Edmund Emeril Kemper II. Edmund II was a World War II veteran who, after the war, tested nuclear weapons in the Pacific Proving Grounds before returning to California, where he worked as an electrician. Carnell often complained about Edmund II's menial electrician job, and he later said suicide missions in wartime and the atomic bomb testings were nothing compared to living with her, and that Carnell affected him more than 396 days and nights of fighting on the front did. Weighing 13 pounds as a newborn, Kemper was a head taller than his peers by the age of 4. Early on, he exhibited antisocial behavior, such as cruelty to animals. At the age of 10, he buried a pet cat alive. Once it died, he dug it up, decapitated it, and mounted its head on a spike. Kemper later stated that he derived pleasure from successfully lying to his family about killing the cat. At the age of 13, he killed another family cat when he perceived it to be favoring his younger sister, Alan Lee Kemper. Over time, he kept pieces of it in his closet until his mother found them. Kemper had a dark fantasy life. He performed rituals with his younger sister's dolls that culminated in him removing their heads and hands. And on one occasion, when his elder sister, Susan Hughley Kemper, teased him and asked why he did not try to kiss his teacher, he replied, "If I kiss her, I'll have to kill her first." He also recalled that as a young boy, he would sneak out of his house and, armed with his father's bayonet, go to his second grade teacher's house to watch her through the window. He stated in later interviews that some of his favorite games to play as a child were gas chamber and electric chair, in which he asked his younger sister to tie him up and flip an imaginary switch, and then he would tumble over to the floor, pretending that he was being executed by gas inhalation or electric shock. He also had near-death experiences as a child. Once, when his elder sister tried to push him in front of a train, and another, when she successfully pushed him into a deep end of a swimming pool where he almost drowned. Kemper had a close relationship with his father and was devastated when his parents separated in 1957, causing him to be raised in Clarnell in Helena, Montana. He had several dysfunctional relationships with his mother, a neurotic, domineering alcoholic who would frequently belittle, humiliate, and abuse him. Clarnell often made her son sleep in a locked basement because she feared that he would harm his sisters. Regularly mocked him for his large size, he stood 6'4" by the age of 15, and derided him as a real weirdo. She also refused to show him affection out of fear that she would turn him gay, and told the young Kemper that he reminded her of his father and that no woman would ever love him. Kemper later described her as a sick, angry woman, and it had been postulated that she suffered from borderline personality disorder. At the age of 14, Kemper ran away from home in an attempt to reconcile with his father in Van Nuys, California. Once there, he learned that his father had remarried and had a stepson. Kemper stayed with his father for a short while until the elder Kemper sent him to live with his paternal grandparents, who lived on a ranch in the mountains in Norfolk. Kemper hated living in North Fork. He described his grandparents as senile and said that his grandmother was constantly emasculating me and my grandfather. When you need to figure out, in many cases, what went wrong, not that it makes it an excuse or anything, but when you kind of see what ingredients go into the cake, you realize why it tastes like shit. Mm-hmm. If you're putting all the wrong things into it.
You can definitely see the pattern of why he had such a hate for women, mm-hmm. you know, with not only his mother, but his grandmother.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure his sisters played into that as well. But when all your female, you know, role models or examples when you're a young, impressionable male mm-hmm. are terrible to the men around you and you.
Yeah.
It doesn't excuse what he did, but you can see where that hate developed.
Sure. People are, I mean, it's a, my analogy is a cake, but it's, you know, it's a simplistic one, but it's kind of accurate. You know, when you're mixing it up and you're, you know, getting the dough and everything ready mm-hmm. to be baked, you know, you can add whatever the hell you want into it. You know, once it's in there, pretty hard to get it out for the most part. But sometimes if you put too many sprinkles in or something, you know, you can pick them out and, you know, it's still a little moldable at that point to do some correction. Then it starts baking, mm-hmm. you know, and at that point, you know, can't really fix a lot of it at that point. And then at one point it's baked. It is now a adult. Mm-hmm. And then that's your cake. That's the flavors that come with the cake. Now you can put a shitload of frosting on the cake and it may make the cake taste better, may mask some of the flavors, but still that cake is going to have these things baked in. And that's what people fail to, I think, realize so often with children is, all the shit that you're baking into this person ain't gonna go away. Mm-hmm. So you better be pretty damn careful how you're baking that fucking cake.
Yeah.
And what you're putting into it. Because they can put tons of frosting on it. Or in some cases like this, you don't, you know, they don't want to frost the cake. They're like, fuck it, I hate frosting. I'm good with the cake as is.
Uh-huh.
And then that's what you get.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, it's something that, obviously, you know, we think about, you know, quite often when you see how kids are being brought up, you know, some good homes, good people, good parents and good surroundings, and some not so much.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes this happens. Let's go to our next chapter in his story. On August 27th, 1964, Kemper was sitting at the kitchen table with his grandmother, Maud Matilda Hughley Kemper. They had an argument. Enraged, Kemper stormed off and retrieved a rifle that his grandfather had given him for hunting. He then re-entered the kitchen and fatally shot his grandmother in the head before firing twice more into her back. Some accounts mention that she also suffered multiple post-mortem stab wounds with a kitchen knife. When Kemper's grandfather, Edmund Emil Kemper, returned from grocery shopping, Kemper went outside and fatally shot him in the driveway. He was unsure of what to do next and so phoned his mother, who urged him to contact the local police. Kemper then called the police and waited to be taken into custody. After his arrest, Kemper said that he just wanted to see what it felt like to kill Grandma and testified that he killed his grandfather so he would not have to find out that his wife was dead. Psychiatrist Donald Lund, who interviewed Kemper at length during adulthood, wrote that with these murders in his way, he'd avenge the rejection of both his father and his mother. Kemper's crimes were deemed incomprehensible for a 15-year-old to commit, and court psychiatrists diagnosed him as a paranoid schizophrenic before sending him to a state hospital and maximum security facility that houses mentally ill convicts. In California, youth authority psychiatrists and social workers diagnosed with the court psychiatrist diagnoses. Their report stated that Kemper showed no signs or no flight of ideas, no interference with thought, no expression of delusions or hallucinations, and no evidence of bizarre thinking. They also observed him to be intelligent and introspective. Initial testing measured his IQ at 136, over two standard deviations above average. He was re-diagnosed with a less severe condition, a personality trait disturbance, passive-aggressive type. Later on in his time, Kemper was given another IQ test, which gave a higher result, 145. Kemper endeared himself to his psychiatrist by being a model prisoner and was trained to administer psychiatric tests to other inmates. One of his psychiatrists later said he was a very good worker, and this is not a typical type of sociopath. He really took pride in his work. Kemper also became a member of the JCs while at the hospital and said he developed some new tests and some new scales in the Minnesota Multifaceted Personality Inventory. Specifically, an overt hostility scale during his work there. After a second test, Kemper said that being able to understand how these tests function allowed him to manipulate his psychiatrist and admitted that he learned a lot from the sex offenders to whom he administered tests. For example, they told him it was best to kill a woman after raping her to avoid leaving witnesses. Releases and time between murders. December 18, 1969, his 21st birthday, Kemper was released on parole against the recommendations of psychiatrists at the hospital. He was released into the care of his mother, Cornell, who had remarried, taking the surname Sandberg, and then divorced again at 609 A. Ord Street in Aptos, California, a short drive from where she worked as an administrative assistant at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Kemper later demonstrated further to his psychiatrist that he was rehabilitated. On November 29, 1972, his juvenile records were permanently expunged. The last report from his probation psychiatrist read, "If I were to see this patient without having any history available or getting any history from him, I would think we're dealing with just a very well-adjusted young man who had initiative, intelligence, and who was free of any psychiatric illnesses. It is my opinion that he has made a very excellent response to the years of treatment and rehabilitation, and I would see no psychiatric reason to consider him to be of any danger to himself or to any member of society, since it may allow him more freedom as an adult to develop his potential. I would consider it reasonable to have a permanent expungement of his juvenile records." While staying with his mother, Kemper attended community college in accordance with his parole requirements and had hoped he would become a police officer, but was rejected because of his size. At the time of his release, Kemper stood 6'9" tall, which led to the nickname Big Ed. Kemper maintained relationships with Santa Cruz police officers despite his rejection to join the force and became a self-described friendly nuisance at a bar called the Jury Room, which was a popular hangout for local law enforcement officers. Kemper worked a series of menial jobs before securing employment with the State of California Highway Department. During this time, his relationship with Clarinell remained toxic and hostile, with mother and son having frequent arguments, which their neighbors often overheard. Kemper later described the arguments he had with his mother around this time, stating, "My mother and I started right in on our horrendous battles, just horrible battles, violent and vicious. I've never been in such a vicious verbal battle with anyone. It would go to fists with a man, but this was my mother, and I couldn't stand the thought of my mother and I doing these things. She insisted on it, and just over stupid things. I remember one roof raiser was over whether I should have my teeth cleaned. When he had saved enough money, Kemper moved out to live with a friend in Elmira. Here, he still complained of being unable to get away from his mother, as she regularly phoned him and paid him surprise visits. He often had financial difficulties, which resulted in him frequently returning to his mother's apartment in Aptos. At a Santa Cruz beach, Kemper met a student from Turlock High School, whom he became engaged to in March of 1973. The engagement was broken off after Kemper's second arrest, and his fiancée's parents requested that her name would not be revealed to the public. The same year, he began working for the highway department. Kemper was hit by a car while he was riding a motorcycle that he had recently purchased. His arm was badly injured in the crash, and he received a $15,000 settlement in the civil suit he filed against the car's driver. As he was driving around in the 1969 Ford Galaxy he bought with part of his settlement money, he noticed a large number of young women hitchhiking and began storing plastic bags, knives, blankets, and handcuffs in his car. He then began picking up young women and peacefully letting them go. According to Kemper, he picked up around 150 such hitchhikers before he felt homicidal sexual urges, which he called his little zapples, and began acting on them. So it makes you wonder how many women looked back on all this when it came out.
Yeah.
That he was doing these things and went, holy shit, I think I got a ride from him once and nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
But saying that he had just, you know, went and did the hitchhiking thing so many times without ever acting out. It reminds me of BTK a bit, where so many people in Wichita would tell how many interactions they had with this guy over the years.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What?
I have a story I haven't told you, but I can't prove that it was him.
BTK?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm 15, and my parents are looking for my first car.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this guy up in Park City, and he's got this old, it wasn't a Mustang, it was a Maverick. It was an old Ford Maverick, and my dad thought, oh, that'd be cool.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be cool for her to have. And he said it was like his aunt's or somebody's that he was selling the car for. So we go up there. We meet him at the Coliseum parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
We go ride around with him and test drive the car. He didn't want us to just test drive it and come back, you know, leaving our car there. He wanted to go with us. So, of course, my dad was like, yeah, we're going to test drive it, but I'm going to. So we test drive the car. Ended up not buying it. Talked to him for a little while. Tony, I swear to God, it was him. I do. It description matched, and he lived in Park City, and it's like,
do we know the cars he had? I mean, I wonder if that could be tracked.
I don't know, but I mean, this is, you know, how more than half my life ago.
Yeah,
but it's a memory that I have not forgotten, because I've always wondered, was that him just trying to do normal shit like sell an old car?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even joking.
Why have you never told me this one?
Because I can't prove that it was him. I don't know, but it matched the description. And sure. I was like, I've seen that guy, and I've seen that guy in Park City.
You know, and I'm not saying that it wasn't him, but I will say this. And tell me if you agree.
He's fairly normal looking.
Well, I don't know about normal looking, because honestly, I go to other cities and I don't see a lot of people that stand out to me as looking like BTK.
Mm-hmm.
But you do walk around Wichita, there's a shitload of men that look like BTK. There really are.
Yeah.
Am I off on that? Because I really felt that when I moved there, I'm like, God, why are so many men rocking the Dennis Rader look?
I don't know, but that's one of those things that, you know, we test drove so many cars, but that's the only one
that stood out.
Stood out.
What? So he wanted to just take you for the test drive?
No, he wouldn't let my dad and I just test drive it.
Oh, he wanted to sit in the back seat.
Yeah, he wanted to be along with it. And there was no way I was going to get in this car with this guy, obviously, as a 15-year-old girl.
Yeah.
So he wanted to go along. But, I mean, we were like, well, you stay here with our car and we'll go drive this car.
Yeah.
You know, that's a test drive.
Yeah.
But he, so we were in a car with a guy that I really, truly do think was Dennis Rader.
Test driving a car with BTK.
But like I said, it may not have been him, but the fact that he's like, oh yeah, I live up close to the Coliseum. And the Coliseum is like an arena.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a good meeting place.
Yeah. Right by his house where it was. He was a stone's throw away.
Yeah.
That's a fun adventure.
I guess I just never told you because it's like, I can't prove it. Sure. I don't remember his name. I don't remember if it was Dennis from Park City.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Or anything like that, but.
That's a new one.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting that. A good BTK story on the Ed Kemper episode.
Sorry.
But you never know what you're going
to
get.
Well, Carol got to do the BTK episode, so.
She did. Are you mad that she
did? No, I'm glad she did because she had so much more to put into that because of being in the media.
I don't think she test drove a car with BTK, though.
Well, I don't know for a fact that it was.
Sure.
It's like, I can't prove it, but I just know it.
Yeah.
And everybody's going to think, oh, sure, Jenny, you're full of shit. You're making up this story. No.
No, I mean, got to keep in mind, I mean, Park City is a little suburb of Wichita it's right outside of the city. It touches it. It's not big. I mean, the population is...
We need to drive 20 minutes to get up there.
Menial.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's very small. So, you know, it's very plausible that is what happened. It really is not... You know, if you're listening to this without, because obviously we lived there, so we kind of know, you know, how small kind of these areas can be. It's a very plausible story of what you're telling. It's not like a far-fetched, you think he looked like him.
But. No, but I mean, either way, even if it wasn't him, it's scary.
Yeah, it is. It is. But wow. Well, there you go. So continue talking about Ed Kemper.
Yeah, I don't have any Ed Kemper stories.
No, well, that's probably a good thing. Look, I have all these interactions with serial killers over the years. Let's continue on with this dark story. Between May of 1972 and April of 1973, Kemper killed 8 people. He would pick up female students who were hitchhiking and take them to isolated areas where he would shoot, stab, smother, or strangle them. He would then take their bodies back to his home where he would decapitate them, perform things on them, on their severed heads, have sexual intercourse with their corpses, and then dismember them. During the 11-month murder spree, he killed 5 college students, 1 high school student, his mother, and his mother's best friend. Kemper had stated in interviews that he would often go out in search of victims after having arguments with his mother, that she refused to introduce him to women attending the university where she worked. He recalled some would say, "You're just like your father. You don't deserve to get to know them." Psychiatrists and Kemper himself have espoused the belief that the young women were surrogates for his ultimate target, his mother. On May 7, 1972, Kemper was driving in Berkeley when he picked up 2 18-year-old hitchhiking Fresno State students, Marianne Pesci and Anita Mary Lucisa, on the pretext of taking them to Stanford University. After driving for an hour, he managed to reach a secluded wooded area near Alameda, with which he was familiar from his work at the highway department. Without alerting his passengers that he had changed his directions from where they wanted to go, here he handcuffed them together in the trunk, then stabbed and strangled Pesci to death before killing the other in a similar manner. Kemper later confessed that while handcuffing Pesci, he brushed the back of his hand against one of her breasts and it embarrassed him, adding that he said, "Whoops, I'm sorry," or something like that. after grazing her breast despite murdering her minutes later. Kemper put both of the woman's bodies in the trunk of his Ford Galaxy and returned to his apartment. He was stopped on the way by a police officer for having a broken taillight, but the officer did not detect the corpses in the car. Kemper's roommate was not at home, so he took the bodies into his apartment, where he took photographs of and had sexual intercourse with the naked corpses before dismembering them. He then put the body parts into plastic bags, which he later abandoned near Loma Prieta, before disposing of the bodies. Severed heads in the ravine, Kemper engaged with both of them. In August, Pesci's skull was found on the mountain. An extensive search failed to turn up the rest of her remains or trace of the other. On the evening of September 14, 1972, Kemper picked up a 15-year-old dance student named Akio Ku, who had decided to hitchhike to a dance class after missing her bus. He again drove to a remote area where he pulled a gun on Ku before accidentally locking himself out of his car. However, Ku let him back inside as he had previously gained the 15-year-old's trust while holding her at gunpoint. Back inside the car, he proceeded to choke her unconscious, rape her, and kill her. Kemper subsequently packed Ku's body into the trunk of his car and went to a nearby bar to have a few drinks before returning to his apartment. He later confessed that after exiting the bar, he opened the trunk of his car, admiring his catch like a fisherman. Back at his apartment, he had sexual intercourse with the corpse before dismembering and disposing of the remains in a similar manner as to his previous two victims. Ku's mother called the police to report the disappearance of her daughter and put up hundreds of flyers asking for information, but did not receive any responses regarding her daughter's location or status. On January 7, 1973, Kemper, who had moved back in with his mother, was driving around the Cerebro College campus where he picked up 18-year-old student Cynthia Ann Shawl. He drove to a sequestered wooded area and fatally shot her with a .22 caliber pistol. He then placed her body in the trunk of his car, drove to his mother's house where he kept her body hidden in a closet in his room overnight. When his mother left for work the next morning, he had sexual intercourse with her and removed the bullet from Shawl's corpse before dismembering and decapitating her in his mother's bathtub. Kemper kept Shawl's severed head for several days, regularly engaging with it before burying it in his mother's garden, facing upward towards her bedroom. After his arrest, he stated that he did this because his mother always wanted people to look up to her. He discarded the rest of Shawl's remains by throwing them off a cliff. Over the course of the following few weeks, all but her head and right hand were discovered and pieced together like a macabre jigsaw puzzle. A pathologist determined that Shawl had been cut into pieces with a power saw. On February 5, 1973, after a heated argument with his mother, Kemper left his house in search of possible victims. With heightened suspicion of a serial killer preying on hitchhikers in the Santa Cruz area, students were advised to only accept rides from cars with university stickers on them. Kemper had such a sticker as his mother worked at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He encountered 23-year-old Rosalind Heather Thorpe and 20-year-old Alice Helen Liu on the UCSC campus. According to Kemper, Thorpe entered his car first, which reassured Liu to also enter. He then fatally shot Thorpe and Liu with his .22 caliber pistol and wrapped their bodies in blankets. Kemper again brought his victims back to his mother's house. This time, he beheaded them in his car and carried the headless corpses into his mother's house to have sexual intercourse with them. He then dismembered the bodies, removed the bullets to prevent identification, and the next morning discarded their remains. Some remains were found at the Eden Canyon a week later, and more were found near Highway 1 in March. When questioned in the interview as to why he decapitated his victims, he explained, "The head trip fantasies were a bit like a trophy. You know, the head is where everything is at. The brain, eyes, mouth, that's the person. I remember being told as a kid, you cut off the head and the body dies. The body is nothing after the head is cut off. Well, that's not quite true. There's a lot left in the girl's body without the head. Carnell Sandburg and Sally Hallett. On April 20th, 1973, after coming home from a party, 52-year-old Clarinelle Elizabeth Strandberg awakened her son with her arrival. While sitting in her bed reading a book, she noticed Kemper enter the room and said to him, "I suppose you're going to want to sit up all night and talk now." Kemper replied, "No, good night." He then waited for her to fall asleep before returning to bludgeon her with a claw hammer and slit her throat with a knife. He subsequently decapitated her and engaged with her severed head before using it as a dartboard. Kemper stated that he put her head on a shelf and screamed at it for an hour, threw darts at it, and ultimately smashed her face in. He also cut out her tongue and larynx and put them in the garbage disposal. However, the garbage disposal could not break down the tough vocal cords and ejected the tissue back into the sink. That seemed appropriate, Kemper later said, as much as she'd bitched and screamed and yelled at me over so many years. Kemper then hid his mother's corpse in a closet and went out to drink at a nearby bar. Upon his return, he invited his mother's best friend, 59-year-old Sarah Taylor Hallett, over to the house to have dinner and watch a movie. When Hallett arrived, Kemper strangled her to death to create a cover story that his mother and Hallett had gone away together on vacation. He subsequently put Hallett's corpse in the closet, obscured any outward signs of a disturbance, and left a note to the police. It read, "Approximately 5:15 a.m. Saturday, no need for her to suffer anymore at the hands of this horrible, murderous butcher." It was quick, asleep, the way I wanted it. Not sloppy and incomplete, gents, just a lack of time. I got things to do. Afterwards, Kemper fled the scene. He drove nonstop to Pueblo, Colorado, taking caffeine pills to stay awake for the over 1,000-mile journey. He had three guns and hundreds of rounds of ammunition in his car and believed he was the target of an active manhunt. After not hearing any news on the radio about the murders of his mother and Hallett when he arrived in Pueblo, he found a phone booth and called the police. He confessed to the murders of his mother and Hallett, but the police did not take his call seriously and told him to call back at a later time. Several hours later, Kemper called again, asking to speak to an officer he personally knew. He confessed to that officer of killing his mother and Hallett and waited for the police to arrive to take him into custody, where he also confessed to the murders of the six students. When asked in a later interview why he turned himself in, Kemper said, "The original purpose was gone. It wasn't serving any physical or real emotional purpose. It was just a pure waste of time. Emotionally, I couldn't handle it much longer. Towards the end there, I started feeling the folly of the whole damn thing. At the point of near exhaustion, near collapse, I just said to hell with it and called it all off." And that's why we don't get in cars with strangers.
Yeah.
It's interesting that, you know, the protocol of the time, you have this serial killer going around. And it sounds like they had some suspicion that it might have something to do, or hitchhiking might be part of the plan
mm-hmm.
that people are experiencing. And the reaction is not, "Don't get into cars with hitchhikers, period." It's, "Only get into the cars with the university stickers." Because that shit ain't fakeable. Or...
Right. Right.
I mean, it's like this... There's this bizarre human desire to never, like, take things head on where the rest of us go and say, "No, this is how you stop shit from happening."
Mm-hmm.
It's always, let's kind of do this half-assed version first.
Yeah.
See what happens.
Yeah, and that worked well.
It's messed up. Another thing that we didn't touch on from the previous chapter was the fact that at the time, and I don't know that they would do it today, but the psychologist or the psychiatrist were like, "He's good. Only killed his grandparents 4 or 5 years ago, but he's cool now."
They only kept him for 6 years.
Yeah.
Because of that. And then they developed so much trust that they allowed him to go around and examine the other, you know, I don't know the right word. I don't know if they're inmates or hospital patients.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. He was damn good at fooling people.
It's just amazing that you're even able to fool people after doing something like that. Even if it was, you know, you're 15 doing it. That, yeah, you can fool people and make people think that you're not going to do that again. But sorry, you've already checked this box. Mm-hmm. There's certain freedoms you're just not going to get.
Did he make them believe like they were abusing him and that it was like a self-defense thing?
I don't know. It didn't really get into that. In that grid of detail, but I wonder if that was part of it. I'd want to know what the logic was behind thinking, okay. Because if that's the case, I understand that a bit more.
Well, yeah, because he had to have garnered some sympathy for them to treat him the way that they did with, you know, allowing him to be so trusted, but then allowing him out after 6 years.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Continuing on with the Ed Kemper story here on the dark side of Wikipedia. Kemper was indicted on 8 counts of first-degree murder on May 7, 1973. He was assigned to Chief Public Defender of Santa Cruz County, Attorney Jim Jackson. Due to Kemper's explicit and detailed confession, his counsel's only option was to plead not guilty by reason of insanity to the charges. Kemper twice tried to commit suicide in custody. His trial went ahead on October 23, 1973. 3 court-appointed psychiatrists found Kemper to be legally sane. One of the psychiatrists, Dr. Joel Ford, investigated his juvenile records and the diagnosis that was once psychotic. Ford also interviewed Kemper, including under truth serum, and relayed to the court that Kemper had engaged in cannibalism, alleging that he sliced flesh from the legs of his victims, then cooked and consumed these strips of flesh in a casserole. Nevertheless, Ford determined that Kemper was fully cognizant in each case and stated that Kemper enjoyed the prospect of the infamy associated with being labeled a murderer. Kemper later recanted the confession of cannibalism. California used a certain standard which held that for a defendant to establish a defense on the grounds of insanity, it must be clearly proved that in the time of the committing of the act, the party accused was laboring under such a defect of reason from disease of mind and not known the nature and the quality of the act he was doing, or if he did not know it, that he did not know he was doing what was wrong. Kemper appeared to have known that the nature of his acts was wrong, and he showed signs of malice as a forethought. On November 1st, Kemper took the stand. He testified that he killed the victims because he wanted them for myself, like possessions, and attempted to convince the jury that he was insane based on the reasoning that his actions could only have been committed by someone with an aberrant mind. He said two beings inhabited his body, and that when the killer personally took over, it was kind of like blacking out. On November 8, 1973, the 6-man, 6-woman jury deliberated for 5 hours before declaring Kemper sane and guilty on all counts. He asked for the death penalty, requesting death by torture. However, with a moratorium passed on capital punishment by the Supreme Court of California, he instead received 7 years to life for each count, with 3 terms to be served concurrently, and was sentenced to the California Medical Facility. In the California Medical Facility, Kemper was incarcerated in the same prison block as other notorious criminals, such as Herbert Mullen, Charles Manson. Kemper showed particular disdain for Mullen, who committed his murders at the same time and in the same area as Kemper. He described Mullen as just a cold-blooded killer, killing everybody he saw for no good reason. Kemper manipulated and physically intimidated Mullen, who at 5'7" was more than a foot shorter than him. Kemper stated that Mullen had a habit of singing and bothering people when somebody tried to watch TV. So I threw water on him to shut him up. Then when he was a good boy, I'd give him peanuts. Herbie liked peanuts. That was effective because pretty soon he asked permission to sing. That's called behavior modification treatment. Kemper remains among the general population in prison and is considered a model prisoner. He was in charge of scheduling other inmates' appointments with psychiatrists and was an accomplished craftsman of ceramic cups. He was also a prolific reader of books on tape for the blind. In 1987, Los Angeles Times article stated that he was the coordinator of the prison's program and had personally spent over 5,000 hours narrating books with several hundred completed recordings to his name. He was retired from these positions in 2015 after he experienced a stroke and was declared medically disabled. He received his first rules violation report in 2016 for failing to provide a urine sample. While in prison, Kemper had participated in a number of interviews, including a segment in the 1982 documentary The Killing of America, as well as an appearance in the 1984 documentary Murder, No Apparent Motive. His interviews have contributed to the understanding of the mind of serial killers. FBI profiler John Douglas described Kemper as among the brightest prison inmates he ever interviewed and capable of rare insight of violent crimes. Kemper is forthcoming about the nature of his crimes, and he stated that he participated in the interviews to save others like himself from killing. At the end of his Murder, No Apparent Motive interview, he said, "There's somebody out there that's watching this and hasn't done that, hasn't killed people and wants to, and rages inside and struggles with that feeling or is so sure they have it under control. They need to talk to somebody about it. Trust somebody enough to sit down and talk about something that isn't a crime. Thinking that way isn't a crime. Doing it isn't just a crime. It's a horrible thing. It doesn't know when to quit, and it can't be stopped easily once it starts." He also conducted an interview with French writer Stephanie Bourgeon in 1991. Kemper was first eligible for parole in 1979. He was denied parole that year, as well as at parole hearings in 1980, 81, and 82. He subsequently waived his right to a hearing in 1985. He was denied parole in 1988 in a hearing where he said, "Society is not ready in any shape or form for me. I can't fault them for that." He was denied parole again in 1991 and in 1994. He then waived his right to a hearing in 1997 and in 2002. He attended the next hearing in 2007, where he was again denied parole. The prosecutor said, "We don't care how much of a model prisoner he is because of the enormity of his crimes." Kemper waived his right to a hearing in 2012. He was denied parole in 2017 and is next eligible in 2024. I'm guessing he's probably never getting out.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's hard to get out of 8 life sentences.
Yeah.
Even if you do confess the way your mind works and help essentially, you know, start the serial killer program with the FBI, which that part is true. That's what Mindhunter is based on, his interviews with John Douglas.
Yeah.
But it's like, now that we know how your mind works, we're never letting you out.
And it almost sounds like in many ways he agrees.
Yeah.
And he's fine with staying in there.
Yeah.
And trying to, you know, obviously, you know, the IQ of that, you know, being able to see all aspects of it is scary as shit, but, you know, it probably has done some good, you know, at the same time for preventing and for identifying others, you know, who do those sort of things.
Or at least how to catch them before they continue.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it yet, Mindhunter, is that on Netflix? Is that?
Yeah, and it's awesome.
It's not an advertisement. They're not buying ads, but if you're wanting to see an interesting version of his story, specifically the interviews, it's worth checking out. That's going to wrap up this episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our program, please press the subscribe button wherever it is you're listening to our program, and please give us a review on Apple Podcasts. That helps us grow in the ratings. Right now, while we are in the early phases of this program, we're going to be giving out a $200 Amazon gift card to somebody who leaves us a review. Just leave that review, send me a screenshot of it, send it to Tony. I'm sorry, send it to review at Dark Side of Wiki, and you will be in the drawing for that. We'll be choosing that winner shortly.
Until next time, for the dark side of Wikipedia, and for Jenny, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.